This episode of Section D was first broadcast on Tuesday, the 9th of April 2013 on Monocle 24. Hello and a very warm welcome to Section D, the weekly design hour here on Monocle 24 with me, Hugo MacDonald. It's come around again. Yes, the 52nd Salone del Mobile Furniture Fair in Milan is upon us. We're currently on the ground, tearing our way around the stands and streets, and we've found a little time to squeeze in a few stories to whet your appetite of what we're up to. Ahead in the next hour, we talk to one of my favourite Italian designers, Luca Nicchetto, about his new joint show at Salone.
The idea was to try to explore this new way to design together with another colleague. And the first things was for us to show that also two designers can work together, not only to be in competition.
We also grab a few moments with Jay Osgoby of Barber Osgoby at the B&B Italia launch.
The business model for furniture companies is about grasping market share from others through excellent design rather than creating unnecessary need in the consumer.
And away from Salone, we sit down with recent Pritzker Prize winner Toyo Ito in Tokyo. We sit down with Singaporean designer Jared Lim and Italian maestro Piero Lissoni. And giving the world of design a small break, we compare and contrast Austrian and Russian approaches to architectural preservation too. That's all to come over the next hour here on Section D. We begin this week's episode at the 52nd Salone del Mobile, currently taking place in Milan. In advance of the week, people had wondered if it might be a slimmer affair than previous years, the recession finally digging its teeth into the design world. And it's true, this year there does seem to be less. But less can be better. And a case in point is the joint collaboration of seven pieces on show by Japanese designer Oki Sato of Nendo and Venetian designer Luca Nicchetto. Their show, simply called Nendo Nicchetto, was nothing short of a masterpiece. And here's Luca telling me how it happened.
The idea was to try to explore this new way to design together with another colleague. And the first things was for us to show that also two designers can work together, not only to be in competition. And so today you can see here the result of this process. There are like a collection that create like a big living room with different typology, like sofa, stool, bookshelf. And each of these products is like one idea that I sent to Oki and Oki finish and vice versa. So it's really, it was a lot of fun without a filter of company that sometimes is good, but in this case was much better don't have. So I'm really happy about this.
And you're being slightly modest because this is an incredibly impressive amount of work that happened in a very short space of time. How many products are there in total in this collection?
The product is seven.
Seven products, and that happened in 3 months.
Yes, exactly.
From scratch, and we're looking at prototypes here, but many of them are going to be in production. Was it an exercise in trying to show that design doesn't have to be something very slow and something that takes a long time and endless amount of sort of bureaucracy that gets in the way, that actually it can be fast and fun and still result in beautiful things?
I think so, especially in the furniture world. I think we can be really, like in 3 months you can do stuff if you want. Sometime when I hear that for to do a sofa or a chair, the company and designer spend like 2-3 years, for me is a little bit crazy, because in 2-3 years you can do a plane if you want. So you need to find a balance.
It's a kick up the bum to the furniture industry.
Maybe.
But the process by which you and Oki from Nendo, he's based in Tokyo, you're based between Stockholm and Venice. How did you actually manage to work together?
Yeah, we managed in a really funny way because we met each other in different city, like, because, you know, our schedule sometimes is crazy because there are a lot of fair and design week everywhere. So, and both of us sometimes we are in the same city. So we decide to make our schedule and to say, okay, we met, I don't know, first time in Tokyo, and after we met in Stockholm, and in Stockholm we decide, okay, now we need to understand when we can see each other again. And so we decide that Oki told me, I will be in Maison Auger in Paris. I say, okay, for Maison Auger, we need to have planned this, and this. So, and after there was a lot of phone call between me and Oki, and just I told you, my bill was like enormous. But it was really easy.
Mm. Do you think it's a model maybe that other designers will see what can happen, and the fact that you both presumably have learned from each other, and also the manufacturers that have produced these products have also learned from you? Do you think it could be a model that might be repeated elsewhere?
I really hope. I think the future could be much more to create a network like this. The music world, for example, teach this. That is possible to work each other and to create a really good stuff and song and so on. So I think also in the furniture and design, I think we need to be more connected to each other, and it's much easier. Mm. It's not only ego, I think.
No, I think you're quite right too. And finally, all the pieces, what connects them is a sort of lightness. We were saying they're not so serious. There's something very, or they start from a nice sort of feeling that you like, or something that you have in everyday life that you've noticed and you think is fun. And then the designs were sort of built from that. Do you think sometimes design can be too serious?
Of course. There are some, not only sometimes, I believe that 90% is too serious. I think we are really lucky to have this opportunity to do this kind of job. And so if we don't put fun in what we design, I think in the end, when you see the object, you can understand that. And I think the design, the world where we live now, need to smile a little bit more.
That was Luca Nicchetto at his exhibition Nendo Nicchetto in Milan there. If you've just joined us, you're listening to Section D here on Monocle 24. It's Milan Design Week time, and we're letting you in gently, seeding a few stories as we go. Stay tuned to hear from Piero Lissoni and Jay Osgoby in a bit. But in the meantime, we're off to Austria. Protecting architectural heritage is never an easy task, but some countries are clearly better at it than others. Take Austria, where strict laws combine with a widespread respect for history to preserve magnificent 18th century palaces and medieval churches. Our Austria correspondent Alexei Korolev compared Austria's success with his native Russia, where feeble attempts to preserve listed sites are crushed by developers and wrong-headed officials.
European countries weren't always in love with their heritage. It was only in the 19th century that widespread awareness of architecture and culture began in Europe. Austrian Emperor Franz Josef I became a pioneer when he created a state commission for the protection of cultural heritage in 1850. More than a century and a half later, the commission's modern-day successor, the Bundesdenkmalamt, the Office for Federal Monuments, is as busy as ever.
We have in 1 year 30,000 answers to give to the people, yes. And this is really, really a lot to do.
Barbara Neubauer is the head of the office. She says most requests are for permission to carry out work or repairs on any of Austria's 37,000 listed sites.
And they have to come to us. And so if they don't come to us, they cannot rebuild something.
Hevig Frisch owns a historic 18th century house in Vienna's central Josefstadt district.
I and my family, we are the sixth generation here in this house. And we appreciate the old building. We moved in here after our marriage and our children grew up here. So they also like it very much, the old building and the thick walls and the old wooden windows and the high ceilings.
On the facade of the house, there are two plaques. one for Frisch's great-uncle and Nobel Prize-winning zoologist Carl von Frisch, and the other for 19th-century Swiss poet Gottfried Keller, who was also connected to the Frisch family.
So the house was also put under protection some 30 years ago or so, so that we must not change anything, which we actually do not want.
It is a sentiment which is shared by many in Austria. Well, there's been just one case of deliberate damage being caused to a historic site in the past 10 years. Partly for this reason, heritage crime is only punishable by small fines. But Bundesdenkmalamt head Barbara Neubauer says this should be changed as it might encourage further crime.
This is which makes us sometimes sad, because if somebody damage his or destroys his building, he only have to pay not a lot of money, and this is difficult, because people should know that they destroy really important things.
There is certainly a lack of this knowledge in Russia. Since the breakup of the Soviet Union in 1991, hundreds of historic buildings in Moscow and other cities have been bulldozed and blighted by greedy developers. Right now, they're claiming another victim, a central Moscow mansion which featured in Leo Tolstoy's iconic novel, War and Peace.
There is a very important term in the history of culture, the term genius of the place.
Dmitry Lisitsyn is a member of the Moscow-based heritage group Arkhnadzor.
Some places, these buildings are not masterpieces of architecture, but they are really marked with the presence of some important historical figures.
Lisitsyn speaks as he stands in a one-man protest outside the house of the Bolkonsky Dukes, just a stone's throw from the Kremlin and Red Square.
So the genius of this place is a great Russian writer, Leo Tolstoy. This building was delisted 3 years ago for the interest of some private developers. What they are trying to do, they are trying to build a new building here. So this is a kind of renovation when original building just ceases away.
Works on the Bolkonsky House are being carried out despite a new urban policy initiative proclaimed by Moscow Mayor Sergei Sobyanin 2 years ago, which promised to put a stop to all construction in the city centre. The continuing demolition has prompted Arkhnadzor to launch a series of workshops to teach ordinary Muscovites how to protect the heritage. It's an attempt to teach the basics of conservation to a wider public. Nikita Brusilovsky is an archivist and lecturer in the workshops. The basic things are clear to all. It's bad to pull down a historic building, it's good to save it, but many people don't know the technicalities. These include details of heritage statuses or how to file a complaint with the authorities over an illegal development on a historic site. It's not on the curriculum, but Arkhnadzor also emphasizes the moral side. Dmitry Lisitsyn says developers will not be remembered for what they built, but for what they destroyed.
So people will remember them by these deeds. A lot of people will just say, so, hey, this is a house which Mr. or Mrs. X demolished, and it is the house of old man Bolkonsky.
And it may not be just Moscow developers who aren't frightened by this prospect. Last year, a Russian businessman hit the headlines after having his 18th century French chateau demolished, seemingly by mistake.
Understandably, residents in a French village are upset after a demolition crew accidentally bulldozed the area's beloved 18th century chateau. However, a construction crew was hired to knock down another smaller building on the same grounds. But something went drastically wrong, as the building they were supposed to demolish is still standing. A former owner of the chateau states, "The whole village is in shock. How can this construction firm make such a mistake?"
Herwig Frisch in Vienna says he feels it is his duty to pass his house on to his descendants unchanged.
We feel somehow, how should I say, conservative, and I like the tradition, and of course my family, and we got, so it's not my merit to live here and to get this house, so I inherited it from my parents and grandparents and grandparents, and I would like to preserve this value and conserve the spirit which lives in this house.
For Monaco in Vienna, I'm Alexei Korolev.
Thank you very much for that, Alexei. You're listening to Section D. Up next, we sit down with one of the greatest living architects, Toyo Ito.
You're listening to Section D on Monocle 24, our weekly program on the best in design, architecture, graphics, and fashion. Section D is brought to you by Lexus. Lexus, creating a new chapter in amazing design, technology, and driving.
Welcome back to Section D here on Monocle 24. I'm Hugo MacDonald. The architect Toyo Ito recently won architecture's prestigious Pritzker Prize. He's the sixth Japanese architect to win the prize since it started in 1979. Our Tokyo bureau chief Fiona Wilson spoke to Toyo Ito in his Tokyo office about winning the Pritzker, starting out as an architect, and some recent projects, including his competition plans for Hong Kong's vast West Kowloon project and his efforts in the earthquake-stricken north of Japan.
Congratulations on your Pritzker Prize.
Thank you.
Very good news. Can I just ask you, what does it mean to you to win an award like the Pritzker?
I'm very honoured about the award because amongst all the architects in the world, we feel that this is one of the most honourable awards ever. So to be able to receive this award, I feel very honoured.
The Pritzker jury, when they were talking about your work, they said it projects an air of optimism, lightness and joy, and is infused with both a sense of uniqueness and universality. And I was just wondering if you recognise that in your work. Do you feel a sense of optimism, lightness and joy?
So I feel that architecture, rather than imposing upon people, they should free them, give them a sense of free will to do whatever they want. So I feel that one of the most important purposes in architecture is to be able to bring them happiness, not to give them stress or impose on them something very strong. Rather, we should create something that allow them to relax and feel comfortable and feel freedom when they're within the architecture.
You're the sixth Japanese architect to win the award. What's Japan's secret? Why do you think Japan is so strong when it comes to contemporary architecture?
I feel that the reason for that is because of the technological advances in Japan, especially with the craftsmanship. For instance, a concrete building, one would find a very different touch in Japanese concrete buildings because of the wonderful craftsmanship.
I often feel when I'm looking at your buildings that they connect to their environment. You almost want to bring the environment in or reach out to it somehow, which is sort of opposite of many buildings, which are quite monumental. They sort of impose themselves on the environment. I just wonder, what's your feeling about nature? It, also in terms of the shapes you use. You use a lot of curved forms, and I wondered what the influence of nature is on that.
I refer to nature in Japan, especially because in Japan the seasons change, the conditions change gently. So I refer to nature as a very constantly changing sort of environment. And in Japanese culture, we try to protect nature rather than imposing on nature. So what I try to do in my work is I try to propose architecture that adapts and change with nature and evolve with nature as a whole. That's why in my buildings you would see curvature, or sometimes you would feel as if you're walking in a forest. So in my buildings I would like to be able to reach out in nature in such a way that nature becomes a part of my building.
When I look at buildings like the Todd's building or your Serpentine Pavilion, it feels like very much it's a sort of collaborative process. You're pushing the boundaries of building engineering. Are engineers critical to the whole process?
I have been collaborating with a few structural engineers in a lot of projects. I tried to involve them in a very early stage, and that's how I got them to collaborate seamlessly with me to create forms that has never existed before, something that's very new and strong and also has a very great impact in terms of structure and architecture.
Why did you want to become an architect in the first place?
I was just basically following the flow. The things that I studied in university basically led me to do an architecture, and I was out of choices in a way. So it was one of my ambitions.
When did you realize that you'd made a good choice?
So ever since I graduated from university, I worked for Kikutake Kinoyori, who is a metabolist. I've worked for him for 4 years, and within these 4 years, I started to realize that, my passion in architecture, and I really worked hard into learning things about architecture. Without those 4 years of experience, I would say that I could have just thrown architecture away, perhaps.
What do you think Kikutake taught you as an architect?
So when I was at Kikutake's office, rather than saying that he said something that inspired me, I actually learned how to really concentrate. The concentration and the energy you put in architecture, I feel is something that I've learned from him the most. For example, using all my bodily senses to design rather than just the head, but actually all the senses like smell or view or feel or look, you know, whatever one could actually be able to sense in architecture, I've learned how to put all these energy together and focus into creating and designing architecture. And by doing that, I could really enjoy and understand the pleasure in designing architecture.
I was just thinking about you as a teacher. I mean, a lot of people have worked in your office and then gone on to be very successful in their own right. And I just wondered if you think about your role as a teacher of young architects and how you guide young architects.
When I'm working with my staff, I don't have the intention to be a teacher. Rather, I always want to think together with them, and that's how the ideas develop, and for a project to become the way it is now has gone through a lot of processes with kind of talking with staff. So I feel that this process actually perhaps was one of the reasons why the staff of my office, after they've left the office, they became good architects, perhaps.
Your opera house in Taiwan, the form of that is so interesting. I don't think I've ever seen anything quite like that. And I just wondered if you could talk a bit about that project.
The Taichung Opera House could be described as a cave that is interconnected vertically and horizontally. I feel that created a continuous cave would be the right word to describe it. It's almost like a spatial continuum. So actually at the beginning stages of the project, the reason that inspired me to design something like this was that I tried to achieve to basically lose the boundary between interior and exterior so that basically, the interior and the exterior is integrated into one as a continuous space. Recently, I just been visiting the building site quite often, and when I was within the interiors, it does actually feel as if it's a continuous wherever I go. So I'm looking forward to the completion of it.
Your work in Tohoku, I think a lot of people felt that what happened in 2011 was going to be the start of something very new for Japan, new politics, new approach to energy policy. And overall, that just hasn't been the case. And I wondered if your experience has been a good one in terms of the work you're doing there.
I feel that the government, looking at the incident, they have basically applied all these kind of new revival plans for the towns, but they haven't really looked at it in a way that, you know, how what I've been saying today, opening out to nature. Rather than doing that, they basically focus on people's privacy and basically focusing on individuals. But I feel that it's kind of a wrong approach. And I think that they should really be more open to nature. And in that way, you open out to nature, new kind of environment would a new lifestyle would arise, whereas a new type of model for Japan in terms of, well, not only architecture but maybe town planning could happen. So I would like to be able to facilitate this by being involved in some projects that in Tohoku as well.
Can I just ask you, your office is, in terms of numbers, is quite small, I think. Is that how you prefer to work? You don't want to have a big office with lots of people, lots of architects. Do you like to keep it quite tight?
I have no intentions of expanding at all. I would love to keep the size of my office, 40 to 50 people. And the reason for that is that that way I would be able to remember their names and know each of them better. And I would like to operate that way.
That was Japanese architect Toyo Ito with our Tokyo Bureau Chief Fiona Wilson there. And our researcher David Pleasant followed up with Fiona shortly after her visit to muse on Ito's legacy a little more.
So Fiona, you've just been lucky enough to meet Japan's famous Toyo Ito, who has just won the Pritzker Prize this year. Can you just tell us a little bit about what your impressions of the man were?
Well, I mean, it's always interesting in Japan when you meet these very famous architects, and I've met most of them now. You know, just so modest. What an incredibly nice, modest person. And it really fits with his work, actually, because his work is very low-key. And it's just, if you meet him, he's just like that. He's asking me questions. He really listens to his staff. He talks to his staff a lot. It's a very collaborative process when he's working. And, you know, I just thought it's really nice to meet someone like that. And they're doing really fantastic work, but there's no ego involved.
That kind of brings me to my next question. We at Monocle, we were luckily enough to meet another great of Japan architecture, Itsuku Hasegawa. And she told us how she's always tried to break down this barrier between that kind of prestigious, almost venerated architect and the public. Do you think Toyo Ito has tried to do that as well? Do you see that as kind of one of his achievements?
I mean, definitely. And just the way he talks about his work, he's really interested in how his work fits into its environment. You know, he wants the outside to come in and vice versa. I don't think he's very interested in building monuments. You know, it's not all about legacy. It's about people using the buildings. And I mean, you just look at any number of his buildings, from small ones, like he did the pavilion in at the Serpentine in 2002, I think it was. And I remember seeing that and just being so impressed. It was such a sort of outdoors kind of building, and it worked so well. And people who used the building really enjoyed it. And I think I've noticed that with a lot of his buildings, that they're really human in their scale and they're very approachable. It's not about making a big landmark on the environment. And although actually some of his buildings are quite, you know, they're very memorable and they do make their mark.
There's that kind of, it's almost a dirty word now in architecture, but there is something iconic about his buildings. For instance, the Tama Art University with its fantastic sweeping arches. I mean, he kind of crosses two boundaries, isn't it? It's that kind of public orientated work. And there is that big gesture, that big statement in a lot of his work, isn't there?
Yeah, I mean, the Pritzker jury, they did mention, you know, that he'd improved public spaces. And I think that a lot of the buildings, like, I think the Tama Art University Library is a really fantastic building. I mean, the building that he talks about, I suppose it was a bit of a turning point for him, was the Sendai Mediatek, which, you know, Sendai is quite a small city, and this building just sort of put it on the map in Japan, really. And that building, what was very interesting about it, it was very transparent. It is very transparent. Literally, it's glass, and you can see the inside. And a lot of his buildings are really pushing the boundaries of engineering, what buildings can do. But there's nothing intimidating about them. I mean, I'd say it wears its kind of innovation quite lightly, his work. And really, I think people just enjoy the buildings.
If we go on to the fact that this is the sixth Pritzker Prize for a Japanese architect, it seems like Japan's getting a good medal count, archi medal count. I mean, do you think that's indicative or a reflection of the quality that can be found throughout Japan? Or is it more about the kind of star architect, or they managed to produce these really kind of top architects? Do you think it's a reflection of what's actually happening on the ground?
Yeah, I mean, I think it's a very fair reflection. I mean, it is pretty impressive. The prize has been going since 1979, and, you know, he's the sixth Japanese architect to win, so it is a pretty good tally. I mean, I think what's different here, say, compared to Europe, is just the freedom that young architects have. I mean, a house here will really only be expected to last about 30 years. So you have this incredible renewal. There's a lot of opportunity for young architects to build houses. And if you look at the work of people like Toyo Ito, Kengo Kuma, Tadeo Ando, they all start out pretty much the same way, by building these small houses, and they make their name doing this. And it's for young architects now, it's the same thing. I mean, I did find it quite amazing to discover that Toyo Ito is 71. I mean, he's the most youthful 71-year-old you could meet. He looks incredibly young. But a lot of young architects have passed through his office and gone on to do incredibly well. And, you know, I think just starting out with small projects, that's how a lot of Japanese architects have really built a great portfolio. They don't necessarily go and work in a big office. They can start out on their own quite early. And then it's interesting to look at Toyo Ito. I mean, his office, he's only got 50 or so people in his office. But when you look at his output, you think, oh, they must have an enormous office. So, I mean, he is one of these, you know, as people say, starchitects, but not actually in the way he works at all. It's just that people like the results.
That was our researcher David Pleasant and Tokyo Bureau Chief Fiona Wilson there. You're listening to Section D here on Monocle 24, and it's time to head back to the Salone del Mobile in Milan. The stars of the design world descend on the city for the whole week, and our own correspondent caught up with one half of British design duo currently enjoying a wealth of work, Barbara Osgoby. Here's Ivan Carvalho with Jay Osgoby at the launch of B&B Italia's new collection on Via Durini.
So this is our first project with B&B Italia. It is the Tobiashi table. And the project really started life as an experiment, I think it's fair to say, in creating a round table which has real sculptural characteristics. Rather than a traditional pedestal table or a table with four legs, we decided to try and make something which felt sort of counterintuitive in a sense, something which was about balancing and about more about an architectural statement possibly than a piece of furniture. And I think that probably refers back to our first project together, where Ed and I designed the loop table originally for Isocon and Capellini, which in the same way played around with this idea of balance and mass and cantilever. I think the Tobiashi table is referring back to that piece.
Now, how was it working with B&B Italia?
Well, it's pretty amazing. You know, we're working with a company that has such an incredible heritage and such a huge amount of understanding and experience in furniture, probably one of the, if not the, one of the, you know, the best in the world. And apart from anything, it's really great fun. But working with them is exciting because they have the ability, the great R&D department, they have really great vision, but also they're really open to other ideas. So they're open to suggestions about material change and materiality, which is what this project's about. This project is about really designing something which offers a function but can be interpreted through different materials to have different characteristics.
Now, the material that we see here on this table, this is the original form of it.
Yeah. The form hasn't really changed, with the exception of the fact that the marble table has holes in the legs to help you carry it and to assemble it, because it's so heavy. The form itself is unchanged. We have it's really in three finishes at the moment. We have it in a sort of grey classic marble, white marble and black marble. We have it in the original sort of stucco finish, which was a materials experiment, which is fascinating. And then this year we're showing it in this bright lacquer finish in blue, smoke blue and candy red colours.
And this is something where they're known for the polyurethane foam. So how was it when you approached them with this project?
Well, I think it was something that they were really excited by, because it's, for them, I think it's quite a big departure from what they, you know, from where, what their, the way they've worked in the past. And as you say, you know, it's not an upholstery project. They excel in upholstery. And the fact is that they can turn their hands to anything because they're geniuses.
Now, Salon du Mobile, for you on the calendar, just to sort of explain, you know, what the feelings you have when you know that it's coming up to April and you have to go to Milan.
Well, Giulio Capellini always used to say, no matter what time of year it was, he always says Milan is tomorrow. And he's right, because it has this horrible ability to whiz around faster than Christmas. And so it's a combination of excitement and nerves very often, and obviously uncertainty. Ed and I often talk about Milan as the Grand National. Like, you set out with 40 horses, but maybe only 20 finish, and of that 20, maybe only 5 have riders on them. So for us, Milan is a little bit like that. You always have the best intentions to launch loads of things, but very often it's only a few make it through. But, I mean, when the weather's great, Milan's the best place to be.
Now, with furniture design, this need to have every year a collection. Now, in fashion, it's every 6 months. Mm-hmm. Do you think perhaps sometimes it could be better to wait?
I think it's always better to wait. And I think of all the designers working, I think today, Ed and I are among the least prolific, because we spend ages getting things right. We don't really make it our mission to launch millions of things every year. And actually we really try and we're sort of counter trend in the sense that we're not hugely excited about the fashion side of design. We everything we do, and we say this, and a number of people said, I suppose, everything we do we expect to last forever. We want the Tobiyoshi table to be an heirloom, not a prêt-à-porter. I think the difference between furniture design and fashion design, or at least the way it should be different, is fashion design is a consumable product, really, which, and by the very fact, nature of the fact that they wear out, clothes wear out, you need to replace them. With furniture, you know, things should be designed to last permanently, and all the manufacturers that we've worked for test the furniture to destruction, and so it really ought to be something that you should keep forever. And I think really the business model for furniture companies is about grasping market share from others through excellent design rather than creating unnecessary need in the consumer.
That was British designer Jay Osgoby of Barber Osgoby with Ivan Carvalho, our Milan correspondent there. Meanwhile, across the street, at another Italian furniture brand, Porro, our associate editor Nelly Goceva spotted Piero Lissoni, perhaps the biggest living name in Italian design, and certainly one of the busiest men in the industry. Charming as ever, though, he took a little time out to tell Nelly about his hopes and fears for the 52nd Salone del Mobile.
We did a lot of different small things. A lot of different small things means a new collection of sofas for living, and part a new collection for Cassina, a new collection of pieces for Cartel, a new collection of pieces for Porro, you know, new table, new chairs, new system, new kitchen. It's a day-by-day work, and every day we're working around of this process. And the process means it's a new pieces inside in a strong, long collection.
Can you just walk me through your designing process? What do you look for when you start creating a new piece from scratch?
You know, the process is quite easy because it's a teamwork. I'm working completely connected with the factory's team. And, you know, I never wake up in the morning with the great ideas. It's a discussion, day-by-day discussion, like exactly like in a marriage. You know, you wake up in the morning, you take a coffee for breakfast, and you start to discuss what happens for the school, what happens for the children, what happens for the new investment, holidays, and something nice, I don't know, for a new evening or the special dinner. Well, it's exactly the same. It's a discussion day-by-day around of something, and sometime something become a project.
And how many people do you have in your design team? How big is this family?
In the family in studio is a strange creator because it's our studio in Milano is a connected and contaminated group of work. It's graphic designers, industrial designers, architects and interiors, and some engineers. And we're working all together in 65 people. That's in Milano.
Can you show me one of your key pieces from this season?
I show to you this key. It's a chair, and that chair it's a particular chair because I designed a chair in 1992, and I used a very antique and original technologies, born in nearby Genova in Chiavari. They was very famous for this special chair named Chiavarina. Well, I did exactly the same with, of course, 100 years later, and I work with the same technologies, and we did in industrial production some chairs. After 1992, we produced more or less 120,000 pieces of that. Think about handmade.
So how long does it take for one chair to be made?
Part of the chair is made in with incredible technologies, and part of the chair is made by hands. Anyway, one chair like that is made in nearby 3 hours.
And because we're here at Salone, can you just tell me what are your expectations of the fair? Are there any new young designers or companies that you're looking forward to?
You know, Salone del Mobile is like, for me, is like a strongly continuity because one salone after the other one, after the other one, after the other one means it's a continuity. And anyway, for me, a Salone del Mobile is like to open a fantastic bottle of wine. You know which wine it's inside, but anyway, when you open a bottle, you discover something new, flavor, new taste, or sometimes you know, the wine is wrong. It's for me like that, you know, I know the wine, but I wait the official opening tomorrow for discover something special.
That was Italian architect and designer Piero Lissoni there with our associate editor Nelly Gociva. Up next, we'll be talking Singaporean design in Milan, and we'll be dropping into the Tribeca studio of Soren Rose too.
You're listening to Section D on Monocle 24, our weekly program on the best in design, architecture, graphics, and fashion. Section D is brought to you by Lexus. Lexus, creating a new chapter in amazing design, technology, and driving.
From the historic center of pencil making to the world's biggest trade fair, Monocle Films profiles a pioneering German stationery brand taking the pencil into the 21st century.
It is more or less in our genes to make pencils. And behind this is not only the region of Nuremberg, it's also the German type of engineering, of really digging deep into things, trying to understand things and to create novelties from this deep understanding of how things are made.
Sharpening Up with Stettler, in the film section on Monocle.com.
Welcome back to Section D here on Monocle 24 with me, Hugo MacDonald. There's time for just one more hit at Salone, though fear not, you can hear our roundup episode next week too. Having worked previously for designer Patrizia Urquiola and the UK's leading furniture manufacturer SCP, Singapore-based designer Jared Lim is in Milan, hosting an exhibition dedicated to young Singaporean designers. They're launching a furniture and accessories brand named Hinika, with a focus on timber. Our contributing editor, Alicia Kirby, dropped by to talk wood.
Hinika's come about because I've been dealing with a lot of manufacturers, especially in the Southeast Asian region. So I've discovered that there's a lot of skills and abilities that haven't been sort of utilized by a lot of designers, but given them the right direction, they can produce some amazing products.
And tell us a little bit about what you're actually showing today. What kind of items?
I'm showing a range of products from indoor to outdoor. So there's some sort of local Indonesian teak wood and some American oak wood products. Everything's very nice and clean. A lot of clean lines, quite Scandinavian or Japanese style. So the products are very practical and aimed at, you know, real life situations, hotels, that sort of thing.
And you mentioned the Japanese connection. The name of your brand is actually taken from a Japanese word.
Yeah, it's taken from the word Itsuno Hinika, which means basically in English, in a simple translation, someday or one day, which is sort of like a hopeful future longing that someday, you know, things will get better. So the idea was that as Hinika develops, you know, I'm slowly making things better, making the environment better, improving things.
And today you're actually here with a kind of group of other Singaporean designers, but this is the first time the kind of Singaporean government body have brought over designers this young. Could you tell us a little bit about this?
Mm-hmm. I think previously the Singapore government has always focused on industry, so bigger companies that are already established. But now they're starting to realize that the young designers are important to the development of the industry and that design in general is going to be a differentiator in how well industries progress and compete with each other.
And Singapore is really kind of on the rise in terms of its design scene. Tell us a little bit about that.
Well, Singapore is such a small nation, so they really have to compete with what they've got and using their minds. And so they don't have any natural resources, so that design helps them differentiate their businesses, differentiate everything in their life, so their interiors.
And its proximity to China is also quite interesting in terms of how they've tried to differentiate themselves mm-hmm. to China. And the way they can do this is actually with their design scene.
Yeah, definitely. So I think Singapore understands that they can't compete with China in terms of manpower or labor or any of those sorts of things. So they have to be smart. So they have to try and do something better with what they've got. So design is basically what that is.
Because Singapore has to rely on other manufacturing, you know, other countries to manufacture their products, as a furniture manufacturer yourself, have you noticed any new kind of places that people are turning to get their products made?
I think Indonesia is becoming one of the big places to get products made. I think a lot of even European companies are discovering that Indonesia is a fantastic place to get things made. And the one thing about the difference between Indonesia and China is the quantity that they're willing to make. In China, everything has to be big. You have to make a lot. In Indonesia, they're quite happy to make small handcrafted items, and they'll make one or two just to test it out.
That was Singaporean designer Jared Lim at his Salone exhibition there, talking to our contributing editor, Alicia Kirby. And that takes us to the end of this week's Section D. This show was produced by Alid John and edited by Holly Fisher. Next week, we'll be giving you the full lowdown of all the fun at the fair in Milan, so be sure to tune in then. We've just time, though, for our weekly studio visit before we go. Danish designer Soren Rose's studio in Tribeca in New York is a peaceful refuge nestled a stone's throw away from New York City's financial district. Inside the sunlit three-story townhouse, the bricks are white and the atmosphere is cosy, simple and pure, much like Soren Rose's furniture. This is where the designer lives, works and relaxes when he's not running around the city or on a plane to Copenhagen.
We're sitting in our office here, which has very high ceilings and faces a very epic Tribeca downtown view of copper stones and these old beautiful buildings, which we surround ourselves with. It's this term in America that they call a live workspace. So the downstairs is a private floor, and then this floor is the studio. So we have our conference room here behind me, and this big room, we just have the, you know, this old Knoll table that everybody sits around, and it's kind of very holistic. If somebody is doing a rendering or have an assignment that they need to do, they can sit at the conference table or they can sit up here. So we kind of like just move around. We all have laptops and it's very floating. And then upstairs, we have a very nice little study, mezzanine, where you can either sit and, you know, work, or you can have a meeting up there. And there's also a very beautiful rooftop where you can go out and, you know, enjoy some fresh air or have your lunch.